Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off this evening. We have a lot that's occurred this week, and one of the most important topics that we're going to discuss, I'm going to be discussed with you this evening, is the scandal that broke yesterday, and I believe Fox Network has been the news agency that broke the scandal. And my gosh, I mean, it's so scandalous, it's even hard to talk about some of these things, because it's not just a minor type of infraction of the law. We're looking at a really major wrongdoing, and it had to do with banks that were wrongful years ago in their mortgage lending practices and their underwriting policies, and they passed this on to so-called investors, who in turn lost heavily on these mortgage securities. Well, the federal government under Obama brought lawsuit, and they ended up with very, very favorable judgments against some of the largest banks in the country. Well, what happened from then, as the story goes, is that, and we have the click-off tonight on our site that'll take you directly to the Fox article, so you'll be able to read in more detail than we'll be discussing this evening. But basically, what happened was that the monies that were collected by our federal government on behalf of victims who were defrauded or whatever because of bogus or overinflated mortgage instruments. Well, what happened was that the monies did not go into the U.S. Treasury, but in turn, Obama administration allowed the banks to pay directly to some of the largest, like RASA. The National Council of RASA got an appreciable amount, and there were others along with them that got tremendous sums of money. I mean, just way, way more than they should have ever gotten. And these were people that were non-victims, okay? And so the Congress got known to this, okay? But basically, the Obama administration funneled billions of dollars to activist organizations through a Department of Justice slush fund scheme, according to congressional investigators. Here's what Republican Representative John Ratcliffe, and he's a Republican from Texas, told Fox News. He said, "It's clear partisan politics played a role in the illicit actions that were made." And then he goes on to say, "The DOJ is the last place this should have occurred." The findings spearheaded by the House Judiciary Committee point to a process shrouded in secrecy, whereby monies were distributed to a labyrinth of nonprofit organizations involved with grassroots activism. And we're seeing that several of those were like one of them that benefited was the National Council of La Raza, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition, and the National Urban League, among others. These were just three of the many that benefited. Well, there's an article. You can go in there and click off and secure more information on this. We also are coming up. We're going to play a clip of Michael Huckabee, okay? And he's going to be telling, in his opinion, what he should... where we should go with this. I mean, it's gotten so horrendously, you could say, scandalous, okay, that people are just coming out and saying, hey, we need to put people in prison and in jail for this. And I believe that's what Michael Huckabee says in this clip coming up. He was interviewed recently by Fox News Network. And just wait just for me. I'll get this thing queued up. And, okay, here we go with former governor of Arkansas, Mike Huckabee. And here's what he thinks about this.
So joining us to shed some light on what this really means is Governor Mike Huckabee. Governor, welcome. Good to see you tonight. I mean,
thank you, Martha.
Volkswagen settles, and you know, and all the people who were mistreated by the banks. We heard so much about it, and didn't you just assume that the money was going to the people who got hurt in those transactions? I mean, it's unbelievable.
Yeah, this is It is unbelievable. Somebody ought to go to prison for this. I mean, this is worse than a mafia shakedown, because at least if the mafia shakes you down for protection, your store doesn't burn down. But this is a case where the liberals have played Robin Hood. They've stolen from the government, the taxpayers, and they've given it to their pals. It's really outrageous. And I think that part of it that is so frustrating, imagine, for example, if under a Republican Department of Justice, the Department of Justice had allocated money to the National Right to Life, or if they'd allocated it to the NRA. Right. Can you imagine how that would have gone over with the Democrats? I don't think very well.
You know, Senator Lankford of Oklahoma and House Judiciary Chairman Bob Goodlatte are behind this Stop Settlement Slush Fund Act of 2017. I mean, this is what we talk about when you talk about draining the swamp, right? I mean, this is pretty murky swamp here.
Well, it's real murky swamp, and the sad thing is, it's taxpayer money, money that should have gone either to the customers of an organization fine. Keep in mind how simple this is. You're a bank. You get fined. Well, instead of paying the full fine to the government, to the Treasury Department, or giving it back to your customers, you instead make a donation to some liberal group. Now, look, Martha, I don't care if the donation is to a liberal or conservative group. This violates the Constitution because only Congress can appropriate money. This is outrageous.
Yeah, and, you know, when you look at the protection of the system in D.C., you know, they looked into it. That both the Government Accountability Office and the Congressional Research Service concluded that the settlement agreements did not violate Congress's power of the purse. So, you know, they sort of circled the wagons on this, right?
Well, sure, they're protecting each other, but I think any simple reading of the Constitution says that you don't have bureaucrats who can just create money out of thin air that doesn't have an appropriation from Congress. Congress has the power of the purse. If it's not an appropriation, I don't care if it's at the state or the federal level, the executive branch can't just go out and say, we'd like to spend some money. Doesn't matter whether Congress has approved it. We're going to spend it because we want to. It doesn't work
like
that.
I mean, how about maybe paying a little bit of that down with the money? But it has to be dispersed to different organizations. Unbelievable. Governor Huckabee, it's always a pleasure to see you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Martha.
Did you hear that? I mean, that's Michael Huckabee, and he's saying some things that were just, God, this is a scandalous type of operation. And so it's not easy to find out exactly where this money goes. In fact, one comment that we have here is by Ted Frank, director of the Competitive Enterprise Institute. Here's what he said. The underlying problem with the slush funds is we don't know exactly where the money is going. Okay? And Frank said the money should go to the Treasury Department. And the process they set up subverts the legislative branch's essential spending power. And the Justice Department has argued that the money is allowed to bypass Treasury because the bank's donations to the groups are voluntary. But the problem with that is that they were under pressure to conclude this settlement with the federal government. And so they were allowed to do this voluntarily, they're saying. So that's some kind of a legalistic type of gobbledygook type of effort by attorneys to excuse the wrongdoing that is obviously there. So, I mean, this is not going to be quick, you know, like, you know, it's over with and everybody didn't do anything or anything. So, anyway, that's so much for that. We have click-offs on our sites to go to the articles, and you'll be able to go there and get full information and really drill down into this. Okay, coming up next, we've got that Trump came forth with a, my gosh, he came forth with an email, a Twitter this morning. And that Twitter says, is accusing, okay? Here's actually, let me read his tweet. And it occurred this morning, okay? It's 4:02 a.m. on the 4th of March, okay? How low has President Obama gone to tap my phone during the very sacred election process? This is Nixon / Watergate, bad or sick guy. That's what Donald Trump said this morning, early this morning, see. He's accusing, now, a spokesman later on today, this is March 4th, said that this is he denied anything that occurred even close to that. So this is going to be an ongoing, you know, tit for tat. I said this, you said that, and so forth. And it's not going to be an easy thing to get out. But anyway, now this next clip that we have coming up is going to be a clip of an NPR actually interview of an editor and one of the chief writers for The New Yorker. And they're talking about this Russian involvement in the Democratic election. But listen to this real carefully and see what you think, and then I'll make some comments when I come back on the other side.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Donald Trump, Vladimir Putin, and the new Cold War is the subject of a new article in The New Yorker about what lay behind Russia's interference in the 2016 election and what lies ahead. The article is called Active Measures, a reference to the type of intelligence operation in which the goal is to take active measures to influence events and undermine a rival power. My guests are two of the three authors of the article. David Remnick is the editor of The New Yorker and was the Washington Post Moscow correspondent for 4 years, starting in 1988. He won a Pulitzer Prize for his book Lenin's Tomb, about the last days of the Soviet Empire. Evan Osnos is a New Yorker staff writer who covers politics and foreign affairs. He formerly reported from China for the magazine. He won a National Book Award for his book Age of Ambition, Chasing Fortune, Truth, and Faith in the New China. David Remnick, Evan Osnos, welcome back to Fresh Air. Evan, let me ask you, what questions did you set out to answer in this article?
Well, for me, it started with a puzzle, which was that we had pretty clear evidence that there had been a Russian operation to hack the Democratic National Committee and the emails of people like John Podesta and other senior Democrats. But it was a strange set of facts, and it led to the obvious question, which was why? Why would this happen now? Why was it, you know, the truth is, look, until recently, we weren't talking all that much about the U.S.-Russia relationship as something in the foreground of our foreign policy. It didn't feel to us as if we were in some sort of obviously hostile dynamic. And yet, all of a sudden, we have what is quite clearly a fairly dramatic interference into American democratic institutions and processes. And so I wanted to figure out, how did they get the capability and the ambition to do this? And I think answering that question would require some combination of both a sort of technical look into what actually happened. Let's try to just sort of clarify as clearly and as lucidly as we can. And then also try to understand what was the strategic and almost the psychological rationale that brought Russia to the point of undertaking this operation.
What they do always, and this is Terry Gross's setting up this interview, and we have a click off. You can go in and read the transcript, or you can listen to the program in its entirety. But what they're good at doing sometimes is setting up a premise, okay? And on this one, they're saying that that Terry Gross is setting it up, and then she turns it over to one of her assistants to do the actual interview. But what they're saying basically, she's saying is that, oh, we all understand and agree that there was Russian sabotage or interference with the election, and that's what caused Hillary to lose. See, this is where they're going at with this Russian connection to interfering with our election. And so then she turns it over to these two individuals that wrote this article, okay, Evan Olnos and David Remnick, and a third person, Joshua Yaffa, okay, and the title of the article is Trump, Putin, and the New Cold War, What Lay Behind Russia's Interference in the 2016 Election and What Lies Ahead. This article basically lays out some history on Putin, the KGB, and so forth. It goes back to Yeltsin and so forth, and it lays out this urge in Putin for nationalism. And, of course, what they've been doing with Trump is making him into some nationalist white supremacist or Bannon still, even then. And I've got some additional clips that are coming up that are going to, I'm playing on another interview that occurred just, well, back in November. This interview that we just are talking about right now and I'm commenting on just occurred in the last few days. It's the NPR. NPR goes way back. It's National Public Radio. It goes way back in time. This National Public Radio and the public broadcast system came out of early education television and radio, okay? And then those were cultivated and helped on by some of the Rockefeller interest, family interest, and then they were morphed into what they are today. But what we have today in the form of national public radio and the public broadcast system is we have a tremendously large propaganda mechanism. And what's really interesting about what's happened in the last few years, especially on the liberal left, is that when Obama went into office, he set up mechanisms by which to afford, I believe, paying a lot of people through benefits and entitlement programs, a lot of money. And you never heard from the liberal left anything about peace. Obama kept prosecuting these wars in Afghanistan and so forth, and we pulled out of Iraq. But then he and Hillary went in very strongly to Libya. And then Syria later. And there was the Benghazi scandal in the middle of those actions. But so here we have Libya is a prime example of Obama's tactics and so forth. And the liberal left didn't say anything. But he and Hillary, actually was pushing for war in Libya. And I'll tell you why they went into Libya was that Gaddafi was becoming a leader of the African alliance or continent. And in doing that, many of the African leaders looked to him for leadership. And also, Libya had a very, very strong economy. And that economy was enabling them to give back to the average citizen quite a bit of money. Okay, they were subsidizing a lot of their living costs and education and so forth. So under Gaddafi, which actually in Libya at the time, and I can't say exactly what I know about Libya today because it has changed some, but under the leadership and the dominance and the governing by Gaddafi, he did not govern solely by himself. He had these tribal council. He had a tribal council that he had to govern in association with. And so he wasn't a lone dictator or anything like that. So the tribal councils, and they had tribes in Libya, and if you belong to a tribe in Libya, you knew by your name and so forth which tribe that you belonged to. So these tribes acted in a coordination with Gaddafi to rule the country. Now, you had some outside interests. He was contemplating going to a gold standard with a gold dinar. He was becoming the leader of Africa. He was going to be resourcing and developing a large underground water resource there in Libya. But also he had allowed Chinese interest in there on oil mining. And if you'll recall, right when there were evacuations that were taking place in Libya and getting a lot of the oil workers and people out, there was 25 or 30,000 Chinese oil workers that had to be evacuated from Libya during the turmoil of the civil war. So your kickers and shakers, you know, movers and shakers worldwide did not want Gaddafi to continue his leadership or dominance. So they went in, and Hillary was the leader of this and prosecuted a war. I don't think, looking back at what Obama was saying, I think he was lukewarm to this. But the person that did the leading into this Libya war was Hillary Clinton. And so, and then later on, even under the War Powers Act, which we don't consider to be that constitutional even today, because Congress never declared war against Libya, nor had they declared war against Syria. So we have these undeclared wars that are unconstitutional. They continue to prosecute these wars. because there's something to gain. And what was to gain in Libya was to take down a leader that they were in opposition to, and to keep him from becoming alliance leader or bringing together those African countries, and to take down those African countries one at a time. That I believe is happening in today's world, in the current news that you see coming out of Africa. But because the Chinese were in there mining oil, because he wanted to take the dinar into a gold standard, because he was resourcing, developing water resources there to turn the desert into, you know, a beautiful oasis. These are some of the reasons that they took down Gaddafi. And so that's basically what we're looking at from that viewpoint. Now, the this change of administration. Now let's talk about what's happened just recently with Trump going in. Hillary and her supporters never imagined, they had it set up, see, for her to win, and they never imagined, okay, that that he would win, that that he had a chance. And that's where this next series of clips that I'm going to play for you come up. And basically, right after the election, around the 19th of November, NPR had an interview, Terry Gross did, and she had an interview that was insightful about Bannon, okay? Steve Bannon has come on the scene. And as a mover and shaker, he comes out of Breitbart, see, okay? And there's nothing good that they say during this interview that that Terry Gross had on NPR nice about Breitbart, nor Steve Bannon. And so we're going to play this next clip for you and see what you think about it. It's there's about three clips in here that I'll be playing. And what I think I'm going to do is I'm going to play each and every one of them. I'm just going to one after the other, okay? And then we'll listen to all of them succession, and then we'll make some comments about it, okay? But listen closely to this first one. And actually, this is the lead-in and the introduction that Terry Gross makes to this this interview.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Perhaps the most controversial move Donald Trump has made since winning the election is the appointment of his campaign chair, Steve Bannon, as chief strategist and senior counselor for the president. Before joining the campaign, Bannon was executive chair of Breitbart News, a far-right website that revels in provocative stories and headlines such as "Birth Control Makes Women Unattractive and Crazy" and "Bill Kristol, Republican Spoiler, Renegade Jew." A New York Times editorial condemned Bannon's appointment, and the Southern Poverty Law Center is circulating a petition urging Trump to rescind the pick. The center has called Breitbart News a white ethno-nationalist propaganda mill. Bannon has described Breitbart News as a platform for the alt-right, but he disputes the charge that he or the website embraces racism or anti-Semitism. To learn more about Bannon, we're going to hear from Joshua Green of Bloomberg Businessweek, who wrote a lengthy profile of him last year before Bannon joined the Trump campaign. Green is the magazine's senior national correspondent and a weekly columnist for the Boston Globe. He spoke with Fresh Air's Dave Davies.
Well, Joshua Green, welcome to Fresh Air. Let's start at the beginning. Tell us about Steve Bannon. Where did he grow up? What was his background like? Because he was in the entertainment end of the financial industry, he ended up making movies. He made a documentary, I guess, about Reagan called In the Face of Evil. This was around the time he connected with Andrew Breitbart. Tell us who he was and how they got together.
Well, Andrew Breitbart was a conservative provocateur, I guess is the best way to put it. But he's someone who lived out in Hollywood. He worked for Matt Drudge, who runs the Drudge Report website. So he's someone who has a deep, deep understanding of kind of how the culture processes political news and how to shape news narratives by focusing people's attention on certain stories or certain storylines. Breitbart was an interesting guy because he lived and circulated in Hollywood, which, as we know, tends to be a bastion of liberalism. But here he was, a conservative, rubbing elbows with people like Arianna Huffington, a lot of other folks. Breitbart delighted in kind of, provoking and outraging those liberals, really derived a lot of joy, I think, from being the skunk at the garden party. Bannon himself was living out in L.A. at the time, had become really smitten with Ronald Reagan after his time in the Navy. He read a book by a conservative author named Peter Schweitzer called Reagan's War and decided, you know, he had the money, he thought he understood the entertainment industry, and he made a documentary called Reagan's War about Schweitzer's book. And it was at the premiere of that movie in 2004, Bannon describes it, that Breitbart essentially came storming out of the audience and gave him a big bear hug in a speech about how guys like them had to take back the culture. And basically Breitbart, I think, conscripted Bannon into what was then, it was pre-Tea Party, but it was that kind of Republican populist view that we have to kind of rise up and take back our government and take back our culture. And Bannon obviously heard a lot in that he liked. And so he wound up becoming a financial backer and then ultimately the executive chairman of Breitbart News after Andrew Breitbart died.
I had forgotten this, but it was Breitbart News that broke the Anthony Weiner texting scandal originally.
It was, yes. And that was a classic Breitbart kind of story in that it took someone who was a liberal culture warrior all over TV, you know, loudly condemning Republicans, and essentially exposed him as a hypocrite in the most embarrassing and humiliating sort of way. And if you remember back to that scandal, you know, initially Weiner denied it, and then he said he'd been hacked, and then there was just this bizarre, surreal scene where Weiner was getting ready to have a press conference, and all of the New York media had assembled around this empty podium, and then out from backstage comes not Anthony Weiner, but Andrew Breitbart himself, who hijacked the press conference and the microphone and began taking questions from astonished reporters. That was a classic Breitbart kind of move, just creating a media firestorm and then kind of gleefully egging it on. And ultimately, you know, that took down Anthony Weiner.
Andrew Breitbart died in 2012 suddenly, and Bannon became executive chairman of Breitbart News. Was his approach any different from Andrew Breitbart?
The way that Bannon describes it, there is a clear continuation from Matt Drudge to Andrew Breitbart to Breitbart News as it exists under Bannon and Larry Solov, who is the CEO. What Bannon told me, I went back and pulled some notes from my interview at the time. He said, Breitbart is almost like a medieval guild where you're passing on that special knowledge. You know, we learned it from Andrew, who learned it from Drudge. We are going to carry on the banner and keep doing what Andrew wanted us to do. So that is sort of the view or the conceit that folks at Breitbart News have, this idea that they're kind of carrying on Breitbart's war against the culture. And that's very much what Bannon seemed to think he was doing over the last few years.
In 2012, when Steve Bannon was the executive editor of Breitbart, he established a research arm, the Government Accountability Institute. What does it do?
Well, Bannon, what attracted me to Bannon originally was that, you know, if you look at kind of the infrastructure, the organizational chart of the Republican right wing, what Hillary Clinton once referred to as the vast right wing conspiracy, what you see is that a lot of the tendrils lead back to Steve Bannon. So not only was Bannon executive chairman of Breitbart News, but then with some of the same financial backers, he started the Government Accountability Institute, which is a nonprofit research organization based in Tallahassee. And whereas Breitbart is gleefully provocative and hard right, the conceit at GAI is that this is a research organization that is going to do digging and stick to the realm of facts, and they're going to investigate corruption and cronyism in government, be it Republican or Democrat. GAI was a pretty sleepy shop, but what really brought GAI into the forefront was that GAI's president, Peter Schweitzer, wrote the book Clinton Cash that became an unexpected bestseller back in the spring of 2015, just as Hillary Clinton was getting ready to launch her presidential campaign. It drove up her unfavorability ratings, and it raised all sorts of pernicious questions about who Clinton and the Clinton Foundation had financial relationships with, and whether or not this was going to be a problem in her presidential campaign. It was clear, I think, from the scope and tenor of the coverage that there was really something there. And that is the other way, I think, in which Bannon has been able to hack mainstream media news coverage, because these Clinton Cash stories and the various relationships that the book documented were intentionally not published on right-wing sites like Breitbart News. What GAI did instead was to reach out to investigative reporters in mainstream media outlets like the New York Times, the Washington Post, and others, and try and encourage their reporters to take this research that they'd done and to go off and do some digging on their own. And they did, and that wound up resulting in front page stories in a lot of major newspapers that got this negative information about Clinton in front of a whole different audience than reads Breitbart News or listens to talk radio.
You see, the NPR has stations all over the country. They're private and public, they say. But they have about 25% of public funding. So they rely on Congress every year and or every few years to do major funding. So the guys of it, I mean, is they're on the liberal left. They supported Hillary versus Trump. They started portraying early on, listening to all their programs, many of their programs in the evening, you know, the drive time type programs. I began to see that they were decidedly against, of course, Trump. He's on that conservative right. They actually should be, they flipped them. What's happened out here is that the liberal left should be, and what they used to say they stood for, they should have stood up and been for Trump. There was every indication with what he was espousing that they should have supported him. But Hillary, because that liberal left is also liberally socially left, see, like Hillary is, and she has this special group out of San Francisco that's very powerful. Pelosi is there. The Pacifica Radio is there. And you've got a lot of Amy Goodman that comes out of there. She's in New York, Pacifica Radio and so forth. So you've got this liberal left that is women-based in many cases that has come in behind Hillary because she's a woman. They wanted to put her into office, see. But actually, they've turned their back on some really major things that they used to stand for. The Pacifica Radio group out there used to be pro-Palestinian, okay? And I think they still are. But they also were a peace group, okay? They were for peace. They were on the peacenik side. And I see that has just fallen away right out of off of their agenda, because Obama went in. He did not maintain peace or establish peace. He kept prosecuting the wars that the big inside money wanted. And they were given things. He set up programs for the liberal left, Democratic left, and they got in on the gravy train is what I see. And so they were all making a tremendous amount of handouts. You know, I believe that they were receiving a lot of handouts during this period. And so they were, they had a lot to gain, okay? So, we're going to play, one clip after the other. There's three or four clips, and then we'll just talk in general and then end up, with that, talking about that segment and move on, to the next segment. Okay, coming up is the first clip, and it was about discussing Bannon and what his personality is like and things like that.
Consternation, criticism, alarm about the appointment of Bannon to a senior-level position in the Trump White House. The concern is that it suggests a tolerance, if not embrace, of racism and anti-Semitism. What about the idea that Breitbart News itself propagates, you know, white supremacist views? I mean, The New York Times editorial on this said, to scroll through Breitbart's headlines is to come upon a parallel universe where black people do nothing but commit crimes, immigrants rape native-born daughters, and feminists want to castrate men. Southern Poverty Law Center says he made Breitbart News a white ethno-nationalist propaganda mill. What's your sense of the content of Breitbart News?
Well, it is certainly inflammatory and fixated on race, on religion, on all the sorts of things that have upset people. I think the thing to understand about Breitbart, and this is not to excuse anything they write or publish, is that they are deliberately provocative. They're aiming to offend and upset people in order to stoke the grassroots anger at government and the broader culture. In internet language, it's an elaborate and effective trolling operation because that is what marshals this group of disaffected Republicans, and other people, sometimes referred to as the alt-right, but essentially this splinter faction of conservatives who have attacked and now taken over the Republican Party over the last 4 or 5 years.
You know, it's one thing if white supremacists read Breitbart News and if they write shocking comments in response to the stories. But as you look at the content, I mean, does the website seem to, you know, embrace and propagate these views of white nationalism and white supremacists? What's your sense?
I think it certainly fuels those views. And, you know, I had a discussion with Bannon about this back in 2015, about, I said, you're a former Harvard guy, you're a Goldman Sachs banker. I'm sort of shocked at some of the things you write because you come out of a culture that isn't, openly racist or anti-Semitic. And what he said essentially was that they are trying to reach an audience that doesn't have an outlet anywhere else in mainstream media. I pulled up some of the quotes. He said, we focus on things like immigration, ISIS, race riots, what he calls the persecution of Christians. He says, we give a perspective that other outlets are not going to give. There are not a lot of outlets that are covering that, at least not from the perspective that we should be running a victory lap every time some sort of traditional value gets undercut. The question I was always interested in getting at with Bannon was, do you really believe this stuff? Because a lot of it is offensive and inflammatory. And he said, personally, I'm mixed on a lot of this stuff, but we're airing a lot of things that traditional people are thinking that don't get mainstream media representation anymore. So they were making a market for these kinds of views and these kinds of stories and attracting an audience, what's turned out to be an extremely large and powerful audience, by tapping these sentiments.
Okay, you see where these people are coming from is that they have taken, you could say, the Liberal Democratic Party, and what they've done was they started off from the very beginning. If you ever looked at the announcement that President Trump made at Trump Tower, he and Ivanka came down the escalator and he made this announcement of his running for president. He did get into immigration, see, but it could not be construed except by the liberal left as being racist. So they immediately took a little bit of what he said about some bad people coming across the border, and he said there's some good people too. And then they took the bad statement of the bad people and turned it into that he's a racist and he's hateful against Mexicanos. See? And so they got a lot of play on that within the liberal left community or the Democratic left community. My work and Charlotte Littlefield's work over the years has been to reach out to everybody. In fact, what I've been working on in the last few years has been a book on what I call delusion. See? And I believe that we all suffer in this state of delusion. And in this state of delusion, it's hard to see that we are deluded, see. And that's the left and the right, see. So it's all across the ways. I mean, from all the political variations from the left to the right, we're all deluded. And if we can begin to understand that we're not fully awake, and that we are in like a sleep state or a deluded state. And the definition that I use of delusion is when you become deluded, you become tricked into a certain way of thinking. Okay? And when you become tricked into a certain way of thinking, you do not see that you've been tricked, see. And I believe it starts at an early age, see. And I believe that when we're born, this process of being of delusion begins, see, through our parents who are also in that in a similar state, see. But anyway, that's the first clip, and they're talking about Bannon being all kinds of terrible things, and that that Breitbart is putting out all kinds of white, you know, supremacist stuff, and they're trying to equate Breitbart and Bannon with Nazism, and that's basically where they're coming from. We're going to play a second clip and then conclude with a third and fourth clip, and then we'll move on to our next topic. But listen to this next clip carefully.
If Bannon was good at pushing Trump in directions of appealing to this provocative populist message, it's in the closing days of the campaign when Trump was muted and on message and not making headlines that he really made progress in the polls. It's kind of an irony, isn't it?
No, I actually wouldn't agree with that. Okay. I think in the closing days of the campaign, if you listen to what Trump was saying, I mean, it was unhinged. I mean, this stuff about dark conspiracy theories and cabals of global bankers, it struck tones, I think, that were anti-Semitic. I would argue that Trump, in the final weeks of the campaign, was mainlining the purest distillation of Bannon's views out there on the stump, and that, to my shock and a lot of other people's, that actually resonated with a much larger segment of the electorate than we had anticipated.
Well, I hope you're catching on to this. You know, we're actually speaking to the choir. I think our major audience in the Austin area is on that conservative right, and probably many of our people listening tonight supported Trump. Our second hour tonight, I edited a little bit of the Trump speech before Congress on Tuesday. I edited it down to a 60-minute segment, and we're going to play that in full during the second hour tonight on The Secret Truth. But you see what this last clip was about? I mean, and they just keep hammering him and propagandizing not only Breitbart but Bannon. Well, we're going to play another one, and we'll end up with a fourth clip, and then we'll move on to further discussions. Okay, there you have that last clip, and I cannot talk to some of these people, and I'll tell you why. What I'm saying tonight is probably on deaf ears, because they made up their mind that Trump is a white supremacist, racist, and all that, and that's the type of information, and they built an idea in their minds. Now, the liberal, in essence, is an idealist, okay? When you're talking about idea or idealist, you're talking about people that begin to think that the idea that has impregnated their minds or they've taken in is reality. So you'll find a lot of very creative people in this area on the liberal left, see, because they are very creative people, and I've met some of the most creative and ingenious people in the creative endeavors I've ever met were liberals. And many of our musicians in the Austin area are in this liberal left, category, so forth. I don't hate the liberal left, and I don't hate the hard right, either. I begin to understand that we're all suffering, and we need to try to come out of this state of delusion, is what I call it, see. And it is a state of delusion, and it's real. And we don't get any better, see. We just sort of die in a state of delusion, hating the world, and they didn't do this for me, and they didn't do that, see. But anyway, that's all we're going to cover tonight on the Bannon. And we have a click off in there on our site, and you can go in and listen to it in more detail. But our next subject this evening is about many of the buildings. The federal officials are putting sensitive materials in foreign-owned buildings. This is in Washington, D.C. And this is making them vulnerable to cyber attack and espionage, and senators were warned of this Friday. Alarm bells went off, you know, and by a report that said that the General Services Administration had been placing FBI agents and other high security government officials in buildings owned by foreign entities in China and other countries. Now, the GSA didn't tell the tenants, according to the government report, so the officials aren't talking, aren't taking additional security precautions. So that's not good. Now, at the end of this article, they're saying that the story was corrected to say the buildings were owned by companies based in foreign countries, not foreign governments, as the original story said. But my point on this is, and something that we should make a very important point of before moving on, is that the Chinese government corporations that are allowed to exist in China itself, okay, are connected directly, in many cases, the biggest ones, the CITIC is one of them, directly to the Chinese government. So if we have a corporation in name, they're working directly under or under the permission of the Chinese government. So according to this article here, they put this little proviso at the end. But if we have buildings in Washington with any Chinese ownership at all, those are the ones that I'd be very, very wary of. And those are the ones I would look at very, very closely. Otherwise, we're not going to get anywhere with this article and this reform. And it's big money. They've moved in Chinese interest. They have a lot of money. They've been buying up stuff. And I will say this: the Chinese people have a hero, and his name is Wei Xinjiang. He has a Wei Xinjiang Foundation in Washington. You can look that up. Xinjiang. He spent 18 years in Chinese prisons, and he knows a lot about China. And he finally got out, and I think Clinton actually helped secure his release. But he has a foundation. He offices in Washington, D.C., and I would recommend that you get in touch with Wei Xinjiang, and he is a leader in the free world for democracy in China. Well, let's get back to these buildings. So these buildings they're claiming are owned by these foreign companies, or you know, in foreign corporations in these foreign countries. And so you know, maybe we shouldn't even allow federal agencies in anything that's not owned by the federal government. You know what I mean? I think that's the way they got into this public-private partnership stuff a number of years ago, and that's when they started creating a lot of this public-private partnership, and it's not good. But anyway, okay, our last commentary tonight, last subject or topic, would be it comes out of the Washington Post. We have a click off here. You go in there and read the entire article and so forth. But here's just another propaganda thing. The title of the article is Adolf Hitler also published a list of crimes committed by groups he didn't like. And what they're saying was, in the speech Tuesday night, Trump was saying that they ought to set up a special department within the Homeland Security. He advocated the creation of the Victims of Immigration Crime Engagement Office, or VOICE. It will, among other things, put out a regular report on illicit doings of the undocumented. He says he's ordered the Department of Homeland Security to create an office to serve the American victims. Okay, but in this, he never stated, okay, anything about any country or group or ethnic group or anything else. He actually just stated victims of crimes committed by illegal aliens, okay? So what has been done in this article, okay, is they've taken this article and they turned it into some kind of an attack or analogous to what Hitler was doing with the Jews, okay? And that's how they bend and twist everything. And, of course, this is the Washington Post, which has a long history of affiliation with the CIA going back to Katherine Graham and her husband. Alan Dulles set up the Project Mockingbird in the 50s. Okay, he was CIA director, and he used to have some of the top journalists and newspaper reporters come into his home in the evening, and he'd give them briefings off the record briefings and so forth. And so these people that begin to get in on this really inside track, they prospered, those people. And so the CIA was running this Mockingbird. It was actually a project, okay, called Project Mockingbird. And now we've got this Washington Post. It's changed hands, to Bezos. And then, but he's putting out some of the same stuff. We're looking at tremendously sophisticated propaganda. It makes Goebbels look like a nothing, you know. I mean, this stuff is Nazi-like in its own essence. And that's what the problem is out here, is that we have people operating, and this is where Trump has been misconstrued recently too, is that he'll make statements like the fake media or the fake news is the enemy of the people. Then they'll come in and say, oh, Hitler said enemy of the people against the Jews. He categorized the Jews as the enemy of the people. Then they'll start putting that on, overlaying it on what Trump said and making it associated with it, what he said. Also, they'll take the fake news or fake media comments and leave out the fake. They'll say things like Trump has said that the media is the enemy of the people. Or they'll also say that the news is the enemy of the people. See, the mainline news is the enemy of the people. But what you've got to be able to try to understand it now in this new environment, beginning at the Mockingbird, and it went back before that too. John Cabot Lodge had a special group, okay, of newspaper reporters shortly after the turn of the century, Theodore Roosevelt's period and all that. But so John Cabot Lodge had a group around him in Washington that was much like the Alan Dulles group in the 50s, around Alan Dulles when he was a CIA director. So what has happened is that, yes, the big money, you know, at the top, the big financial money has taken over ownership, consolidation of our media, and we've got a bunch of parrots running around writing articles, see. And one of my sayings is that the jungle, the world is a jungle full of parrots. Now, I was in that category up until when I was 35 or 40, and then I flew out of that jungle, see. I finally realized where I was. My first 35 years of my life, I was that ego guy. I was a go-getter, real estate, realtor, all that. Was the youngest, you know, member of the board at 23, a designated member. And so I was a go-getter. I was, noise in the real estate business here in Austin, Texas. But I was ego-driven, see. I wasn't internally driven, but I didn't know that, see. So it took me a number of years to come out and start thinking. From between 35 and 40, I began to consolidate my thinking and saying, oh my gosh, I don't like that ego state, see. I want to overcome that. I want to do something better than that, than just being into this big ego, see. And so I started reflecting on my own weaknesses and shortcomings. But what today, my stance is I'm more independent than anything. I my own personal politicals, preferences would be on the conservative side, both socially, politically, morally, and everything. I believe in God, so I'm God-centered. I'm a conservative. I'm not into a lot of liberal social issues. So, and I'm 73, and I'm not young anymore, see. So my first 35 years or so was in the doldrums. I didn't really catch on. Then I gradually started getting on the net. I built my first computer when I was about 38 or 40. And I began to get in and research, began to write. My first book was Time Dynamism at the university, astrophysics library now. And I started beginning to hypothesize a worldview that I've come to finally reach today, that that my latest book I'm working on is entitled Delusion. And that covers everybody. I don't care if you're a liberal left, Democratic liberal left, or you're a right-wing Republican, you know, person. It covers everyone. And in this delusion that we suffer in, it's hard to come out of it, see. It's not easy, okay? And what we have to do is we have to begin, one of my friends, I was writing an earlier book, and there were elements in one of my books, Be Good to Yourself. I started putting elements of the delusion hypothesis in there, and theories and stuff. And he told me at that time, he said, George, they don't want to hear that because they're deluded, so they're not going to even hear the word or the message anyway. And so much for that. But that's where this thing is difficult, is that the delusion that we finally end up being absorbed into is like a field system, see. And in this field system, we don't see the fact that we are deluded by degree, see. And so it's hard for us to cease our state, our mode of slavery. And it's like a thought prison or thought slavery that we have come to exist in. Because what happens is that we become predisposed to certain ways of thinking and being. And in that predisposed state, we just do not come out of it. We just stay in that state, and we're happily or unhappily or sad filled ignoramuses. And I was an ignoramus. I'll say that. I don't deny my earlier mistakes and shortcomings and weaknesses. See, and I was right there with all these people that I was ignorant about things. I didn't really catch on. I was into my ego. Didn't treat women right in some relationships. But then now I have what I call the man problem that I write about and talk to people about. And I really know that men are the problem in the world, the major problem. And there are women every day that I meet or see, you know, in different social levels or whatever. They don't even know what I talk about, or even, and some women on the liberal left, the Democratic left, think I'm crazy that I hate women and stuff. I'm their biggest friend of women in this world, but they don't know it, see, because I understand the way women really think about men, and they don't think very much of them. I'll tell you that. I used to, when I started catching on in my 40s and early 40s, I started, you know, going up to tables where women were people I knew. And I start talking about these issues like this and what women really thought about men and stuff. I think they would say, you're not even close. You don't know what you're talking about. But I did know what I was talking about, because the reaction that I was getting, I was right on top of it. But anyway, we're going to conclude here in a couple of minutes, but we want to thank each and every one of you out there in Radio Land for supporting our broadcast. And we have been, Charlotte and I have been broadcasting a little over 10 years now, be November, December, January. We've been broadcasting for 10 years and 4 months. And we've enjoyed each and every broadcast. We've traveled. We supported Ron Paul. Ron Paul is still the moral base of the Republican Party. And Trump has a lot to learn from Ron Paul. Ron Paul, he stood on principles. If there's one thing you can say about Ron Paul, he was consistently the highest morals, a moralistic person that probably I've ever known. And so Trump should look to Ron Paul for some guidance. But also, Rand Paul and Ron Paul and the Tea Party people and other conservative groups ought to come together behind Trump and help him defend himself from these unwarranted attacks from the liberal left. The liberal left is being funded by your international financiers, and they don't know who they're working for. They're just out there raising hell and in protest, but their protest is unwarranted. Ideas have been placed into their heads about Trump. They're not true. Some of those are not. The whole Washington environment in Congress is so corrupt now that You know, if you say anything about corruption, you got to point your finger at Congress. But anyway, we want to thank you again for listening. And you come out of this deluded state, this delusion by forgiveness. So if you can begin to forgive yourself and others, that is the key to coming out of the delusion and really beginning to experience the beginning of becoming enlightened. On one end, it's a psychopath character. On the other end is the enlightened character. You want to move to the enlightened state, you have to forgive yourself and others. But anyway, I want to thank you for listening tonight. And we'll tune back in next Saturday night, 7 to 9, 89.1 FM in Austin. Thank you. Good night.